Back When is sponsored by Siwi, the National Trust's photo printing partner. Every image captures a story. Siwi's support means the National Trust can protect our nation's memories by caring for and sharing our vast collection of historic photographs. Through our work together, we're uncovering precious and previously unseen images for everyone to enjoy. Discover our work snapshotting 200 years of history. Search online for Siwi, that's C-E-W-E, and the National Trust.
He used to come to Brighton a lot. Before they, he and his wife, Emma Lee, or Emma James, because she had two names, had their first child. They were up on the race course, and he had coconut shies up there. And he said that while he was up there, he lost everything he owned on the turn of a two-headed coin.
Have you ever imagined being a fly on the wall of history? Join me for an inside view of the stories of people, places and moments that made us. I'm historian Helen Antrobus. Lean in for a tale from time, Back When. Today's story is being told by Josie Jeffrey, part of the team at the South Downs celebrating the history and the heritage of gypsy and traveller communities, and a member of the new traveller community herself.
Travelling communities have been a part of Britain's cultural fabric for centuries, but it's often a story that's left untold. A rich and vibrant history is ours to tell, and that starts here. Some of the first records of travellers in Britain go back as far as the 1500s. Around the same time as the Tudors and Henry VIII, with some records hinting at their arrival long before then. Britain's history and identity has always been a big melting pot of people and cultures from all over the planet. From the Romans to the Celts, from the Saxons to the Vikings, our history is one of the richest in the world. Gypsy and travelling communities have many subcultures within.
Gypsy has become a catch-all, the name gypsy. Anyone who travels, people think they're gypsies. Gypsy comes from the word Egyptian, which people thought Romani people were Egyptians when they arrived here.
This is Janet Keep Black, a Romani historian and author of The Gypsies of Britain.
So Romani people originate from India, and you have to be, your ancestors have to have come from India to be a Romani. But they themselves claim to have come from Little Egypt, so that's where the confusion arose.
Like many ethnic groups, depending on which lineage you look at, different parts of history and heritage pop up to paint their own story. Romani people originated from North India, or Little Egypt, an area located in the south of modern Greece. The UK is home to Romani, Irish travellers, Scottish and Welsh travellers, show people, boat people, Roma and new travellers, and many more that are not defined by ethnicity. Simply put, the history and heritage of all of these communities is far and reaching.
Egyptian became Egyptian, became gypsy. So anyone who is of North Indian descent, which I am, travelling traditionally for generations, we're the Romani people. Irish travellers are a recognised ethnic minority, so just different. There has been some intermarriage, of course there is. I mean, that's what happens. Same as in Brighton, there's a lot of Romani blood in this town because travellers have been coming here for hundreds of years and they've been making relationships and settling down with local girls, as my dad did.
Gypsy and traveller communities each have their own unique story to tell. Today, Janet is taking us to explore Brighton and some of the areas in the South Downs, heading over to Lewes Town, where travellers have been passing, trading and settling for hundreds of years. We met Janet outside of the bus garage on the Lewes Road in Brighton, once a stopping place for traveller families in the yard next to the Bear Inn.
A long time ago, before that garage was built, the trams were there first and then the garage. So we're talking about pre-1930. That was part of the yard of the bearing, which is there. And they used to, travellers used to come with their caravans and stop in there. I mean, people think that travellers were a new thing in Bryson, or they haven't been coming here for very long, but in fact, they've been coming here since the 1700s. Not necessarily stopping in there, but they were certainly there in the 1800s. You need to imagine what Bryson was like before 1890, or even 1953. Those have just, the road that goes up alongside, that leads up Hollingdean Road, if you imagine it's going up there, there's a railway bridge, for those who don't know Brighton. Go onto that railway bridge, and before 1953, there was nothing but downland and farmland. That's as recent as that. So you could get from here, work your way up to Ditchling, across the Downs to the Devil's Dyke. You could get almost anywhere on foot.
Travellers are people that often follow a nomadic way of life. Some will go from town to town in vehicles, caravans or tents, while others live in bricks and mortar, housing that they either rent or own. Historically, they would travel along established routes, stopping to work in occupations like agriculture or fairs, helping local businesses or selling and trading items to the people that they met along the way.
Travellers used to come into most towns and villages to winter up. They'd fetch up after the hop picking and the fruit picking, and then they'd stay there until they left again for the hop tying or hop planting, other opportunities for work. And sometimes if they couldn't get into a yard or they didn't have a wagon, they would stop in lodgings.
Some travellers varied their work throughout the year, whilst others stuck to a particular skill, and at times would be known purely by their trade. These included fishing, hop fruit and veg picking, show people, farming, blacksmiths and more. And throughout history, gypsies and travellers have provided essential services wherever there was a need. Some travellers would move throughout the year, and some would lay down roots and take up more permanent roles within the wider community. Around the bus garage and the former site of the tram yard behind the Bear Inn, Janet recalls a family from more modern times, but one that has been stopping and trading in the area for centuries.
Caleb Smith was the one, the main man who used to come and stop here. And I remember them. They used to have a horse and cart, and they used to come out of the yard at the back. And it was before all the gyratory system was built. And they used to come out, and they didn't even look at the traffic. They used to come out, one would stick his crop out, not look at the traffic, and go straight out, ignoring the traffic. All the traffic had to stop. I mean, it wasn't like this. And they were very, very well known around the town, and a lovely family.
Some families would travel alone, and others with another family or close friends, and some would settle near each other. The Smith family of Brighton had the Coopers as their neighbours, and Matthias Cooper, known affectionately as Matty, had a rather peculiar job, and one that he landed after befriending not just any royal, but Queen Victoria herself.
In 1891, and I think 1881 on the census, two of these houses were occupied by travellers. In one of them was Caleb Smith again, he pops up, and his family. There was another chap called Matty Cooper, known as the Royal Rat Catcher. Cooper was born, he said, at Stonehenge. He used to come to Brighton a lot. Before they, he and his wife, Emma Lee, or Emma James, because she had two names, had their first child. They were up on the race course, and he had coconut shies up there. And he said that while he was up there, he lost everything he owned on the turn of a two-headed coin. Everything, even his dog. But it didn't stop him coming back. Later on, he was recorded by Queen Victoria in her diaries because they were stopping opposite the gates of Claremont Park. And she came out and saw them and she got to know them really, really well. And they had their first child there. And Victoria's mother sent out clothes and food for the family. And they were there for a few weeks. And she painted them too, watercolours. There are watercolours, Matty Cooper and his family, of his mother, of his sister, his wife.
Queen Victoria's affection with the Coopers is documented in the Royal Archives, with her noting, "I must say that through what I've seen of their characters, they are a superior set of gypsies, full of respect, quiet discerning, and full of affection for one another." Matty went on to be employed by the royal family as one of several rat catchers at that time, a job that he may have landed due to a colourful appearance.
She used to run alongside Queen Victoria's carriage wearing a yellow suit, and apparently she had yellow flowers put on his grave when he died. This is all family say, but we don't know. But there's often an element of truth. Might be exaggerated, but there's often an element of truth in family say, so.
Away from Matty's royal duties, his family also found work of their own, with his sister providing entertainment for Victorian day trippers at a fairground overlooking the Devil's Dyke on the South Downs.
But he stopped here. And the reason why he came to Brighton initially is because his sister used to tell fortunes up on the Devil's Dyke. She was one of the Devil's Dyke fortune tellers, and she was Jenty Cooper.
Jenty would have been part of a number of attractions at the fairground, most of which would have been owned and operated by gypsy and traveller people known as show people. This lifestyle became hugely popular in the Victorian period and is still largely followed today. My own family used to own and operate a set of swing boats at festivals and fairs across the country. Further along the route, Janet points out droveways, hollowways and other paths that would have been used heavily to build communities, and not just by gypsies and travellers. These were often trade routes used by all workers to service many industries.
Where people used to drive their livestock, either to grazing or to market.
Some of the people using these droveways would travel from place to place in wagons or vardos, settling from time to time as they plied their trades, while others camped out in tents.
Not all of them had wagons. I mean, some of them would find it difficult down the Jugs Road when you get into Kingston, but a lot of them just pushed hand carts. They walked. They carried what they could on their backs. Most of them, although some of them had wagons, were in bender tents. And they used to move those on flat carts, maybe driven by, pulled by a donkey or pony. Or just pushed. I know my great-great-grandfather pushed his handcart. So it's important to remember that it's not only gypsies and travellers who used the South Downs. It's all other communities that relied on getting from place to place in order to earn a crust.
A bender tent was often an indication of gypsies or travellers working in a particular trade or as part of the armed forces. Janet explained their construction as we walked along the droveway. Now a popular bike path and bridleway, Janet told us how any or all spare materials could be used from workplaces to make these shelters.
Bender tents is, some people call them rod tents. They used to bend the rods over, stick one end in the ground, and then they'd either tie them up where they meet, then put a ridge pole across and tie that. So you end up with a tunnel. So that's a bender tent. And they covered it with whatever they could lay their hands on. So it could be army blankets. It could, because they were oiled. Tarpaulin in later days. Sacking. You often see pictures of bender tents with hop sacks on them. So, which tells a story. They've been hop picking and they've got the sacks.
Aside from working at local businesses, some gypsies and travellers would also make work for themselves, something that in modern times is still extremely common. with over a quarter of all people in the workforce identifying as self-employed. Historically on the South Downs, this self-employment would have included anything from gardening to furniture builders, while others focused on selling goods or hawking.
They were very enterprising because some of them went up to the Midlands and bought carpet and the netting curtains, and then go round town selling them. Not all of them did it. They made baskets. They made bee skeps out of materials that they got from the hedgerows. So that's how they earned a living.
Today, gypsies and travellers work in a huge number of roles. Some still preserve their traditional crafts and occupations, and some in regular jobs like office workers, the NHS, schools and universities, and more. Over 71,000 people identified themselves as being from Gypsy or Traveller heritage on the 2021 census. Although the true number is expected to be much higher, as a large proportion of people in the UK will not know how far back their own family tree goes beyond a couple of generations. Part of the reason many will not know is due to this rich history remaining unseen. Romani journalist and blacksmith Jake Bowers is hoping to change that by creating sculptures forged from steel to become iconic symbols across the UK's landscape.
Being part of the Gypsy community is absolutely everything to me. It's where my ancestors come from. It's where my kids are going. It's a massive part of my history and heritage. It's something I'm enormously proud of. Our ancestors were musicians and blacksmiths and animal trainers, and they serviced the needs of the armies for over 1,000 years. They never started a war, died in many, and we've been kind of rendered invisible in modern life.
For Jake, the connection that he feels deep within the landscape and in his soul roots him to his heritage and has become a central thought in deciding where his pieces of art should stand proud.
There are stopping places right the way through the South Downs, places where our ancestors stopped, where our people are buried and where our people were born. And they're invisible. They've been rendered invisible by technological change and by legislation. Gypsy people don't stop there anymore. Let's celebrate that. Let's remember that. And we don't have to do it with a caravan. We don't have to be stereotypical, but let's do it with a symbol of something that hopefully everybody can recognise as being beautiful, which is a horse. You know, Britain is a nation of animal lovers, with some of the best equestrians in the world. There are many horse cultures. You know, you've got the Badminton horse trials, but you've also got the Gypsy horse fairs, which are where horses are still bought and sold, all the way from Appleby in Cumbria to Stowe in the Wold in Gloucestershire. Let's celebrate a gypsy cob and put it back in the landscape. For gypsy people, the image and the symbol of a horse is really, really important because it shows our history as being nomadic people, even if we're not able to be nomadic nowadays. And it shows the animal that is closest to us. It's emotionally intelligent, it's highly beautiful, it's prized by many, and the gypsy cob in particular was a horse breed that was bred to pull gypsy wagons across Britain.
A gypsy cob is a breed of horse synonymous with traveller communities. A strong and hardy horse with characteristic feather-like hair growing around their lower leg and hoof, and a patchwork of piebald or solid colour markings. But the horse is not the only piece of symbolism connecting the art with the communities. The practice of making it from steel also speaks to a long line of tradition.
To make a gypsy horse out of a kind of a technique that is as old as our community is, and weaving it together like a basket, which our ancestors also did, is really important. So it weaves together both the techniques and the imagery and the symbolism of our history into something that we can all be proud of. Bertolt Brecht is one of my favourite artists. He said, "Art is not a mirror to reflect the world. It is a hammer with which to shape it." And they're meant to ask questions, these sculptures. They're meant to pose a challenge to people who see them. and hopefully what comes out of it is a meaningful resolution that actually we need to be more inclusive in terms of our view of who belongs in the British countryside. And every British county has a gypsy history. So that's why we're making 12, because there are hundreds of places which are important for gypsy heritage, which are invisible. And we're making 12 for some of the most well-known ones, but also some of the ones that aren't known about. The one thing I would want people to know is that we, for 500 years, have been part of Britain's past, and we have every determination to be part of its future as well. And we need to be accepted, we need to be celebrated, and we need to be included in the places that we helped to build and were always part of.
Nearing the end of the Stopping Places walk, there is time to celebrate the final piece of heritage and one of the strongest and long-lasting pieces of legacy from the Gypsy and Traveller communities, the influence on music and dance, one which has been preserved and contributed to by travellers as part of their oral history, as well as being big advocates for step dancing.
My friend Vanslow, when he was a young man, used to stop down there when he was very young with his family, extended family. And he told me all about how they used to step dance down there and sing and play different musical instruments. And he told me about what they made. And they played just about every musical instrument. They played fiddles and they played melodeons and accordions. It's not just travellers that used to step dance. It was usually working people, and they wore hobnail boots, and there was usually a fiddler in every village and every town. And if you walked into a pub back in the day, there'd be flagstones on the floor, mainly, or wooden. Now, when you step with hobnail boots across flagstones, you get a sound. If you've got somebody playing the fiddle, what do your feet do? They start tapping, don't they? They start tapping. And then if you shuffle around, it makes a noise. And then it was just organic, the way I believe, the way step dancing grew out of hobnail boots and flagstones. I've seen step dancing done to people clapping, just getting the rhythm from tapping. Whistling, if nobody's there to play a fiddle or anything else. Tambourine, just about anything. Tin whistle, step dance too. Mm-hmm. Got to want to do it. And it's the most natural thing to do. You only have to look at babies. As soon as they pull themselves up onto a chair and music comes on, they're going, or they're stepping from. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the most natural thing to do is dance. And all you need is a pair of hard-soled shoes.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Back When. Be the first to hear new stories by following us on your favourite podcast app. And don't forget to join in with the episode by leaving a comment or sending us a message. All of the details can be found in our episode show notes. And while you're there, you can also find lots more deeper dives into the Gypsy and Traveller history, along with a Spotify playlist of Gypsy folk songs that we found in the archives. Join us again next time for more tales from time back when.
This podcast is sponsored by Siwi, Europe's leading photo printing company. Every image you capture tells a story. Discover ideas for curating and creating your special memories and unique gifts for loved ones. From high-quality, personalised photo books to wall art made from your favourite photos. Head to Siwi, that's cewe.co.uk, and start creating your story.